Hi, this is John Barnes, and you're listening to Cop On.
Hello, welcome. Good Lord, we're live. We're live on YouTube. We are later than live. In your ears, tickling your auricles. This is Cop On Podcast. We're delighted to bring this to you the day after one midfielder managed to score a magical goal from outside the box, a crucial goal that put a smile on all Liverpool fans' faces. So thank you, Cole Palmer. We're going to talk about Man United Chelsea, because that was comedy genius at the end of that in a bit. But that's going to be like the Shakespearean literary device, where, you know, first you have all the serious stuff, the tragedy, the drama, the gripping thing, and then you get this comedy clown coming in, so is act three or act two or something like that, just coming in and being a bit of a, that's going to be the Cole Palmer show. We'll talk about that in the middle. But for now, I'm delighted to be joined by Kev. Abdul may or may not be joining us. Hopefully he will. And we've got loads to discuss, Kev. First of all, the game last night between Liverpool and Sheffield United. And here's Abdul. Great timing. Excellent stuff. Kev, the last night's game, it got to 1-1, right? And we're going to talk through that game in terms of the events that happened chronologically. But I want to jump to that moment when Connor Bradley so unluckily deflected that ball from, I can't even remember his name, Hodor, the Sheffield United player. He went in off Connor Bradley's right boot, the outside of his right boot, and through Queeve's legs. At that point, be honest now, were you bricking it? Or did you just take a deep breath and think, well, here we are again, we're going to get out of it again?
But I wouldn't say I was bricking it. They don't tend to do that to me this season. I've got faith that they can go to 95, 99 minutes. It doesn't matter. What I loved about last night was the ability of Klopp to change things quickly. He saw that things weren't, wasn't clinical enough. It wasn't direct enough. And as soon as that went in, the atmosphere at Anfield just rose. The crowd got up, and it was almost like the crowd took an affront to the fact that Sheffield United had the temerity to get back into it in such a way. It was like, no, we ain't having this. And they literally just turned the volume up, and they cranked the pressure up on the players. Say, look, we're going to drive you on, and you are going to do this, whether you know you think you can do it or not. We're going to drive you on to do it. And lo and behold, Klopp changed the system, changed to a 4-4-2, which I absolutely love. And our ability to attack down the wings and create space where there was no space. You know, Sheffield United went into that game last night with absolutely no intention of playing football in any meaningful sense. They came to park the bus and tried to get out of it with saving face or at best a draw. They had no intention of doing anything else. And once that goal went in, I just felt it was a wave. It was a wave, an avalanche of noise that drove players on. And then you saw the pace quicken up, the speed of play, the speed of thought, the aggression in the counter press. Everything just started to flow much faster. It shouldn't need to get to that stage, you know, and we've been doing this too often this season. We are where we are, and it's happy days. We're at 70 points, delighted with life, but I don't think we've played well that many times this season. And that's a scary prospect for the run-in, because if we do click and we do get it right, then it's going to be an amazing thing to see. But no, last night, I was relaxed enough the fact that I knew we would get chances. And it was just a case of, can the players take them when they come? And fair play to them, they did. And then some with McAllister.
Oh, man, we're going to talk about all of that. Absolutely. We're going to go through the highlights of that game and talk about various talking points, of which there were tons in the Sheffield United game. And then, of course, we're going to preview Man United. Ooh, Old Trafford on Sunday. I'm feeling all jiggly, and especially jiggly because Abdul is here as well. Abdul, how are you? It's been a long time. Abdul from Watch_LFC on Twitter or X.com. How's it going, Abdul?
Yeah, things are good. Things are good. I'm glad to be back. Glad to be here when we're, you know, celebrating lots of wins and stuff. So, yeah.
there's we've worse. Got,
in the podcast, basically. Yeah.
I mean, there was an interesting stat that we've kept one clean sheet in the last 10 games at Anfield. That was quite interesting. So, I mean, obviously, you're coming in here with this optimistic mood, and I'm feeling optimistic, and Kev's feeling optimistic. We're all feeling pretty damn chipper. But is that something that you're concerned about, Abdul? The, you know, need to be a bit tighter at the back, or is there a good explanation for that?
I'm honestly not even sure. What has happened recently? I feel like, you know, everybody watched the team, you know, stack win after win after win. And then when that United loss came in the FA Cup, it almost felt like a tiny bit of a relief. Obviously, it was sad to lose it. We didn't want to lose it. But, you know, it just felt like, how much more can this team do? How many limits? Because we have so many injuries, and literally the players did look really pooped in that final extra time period. And it was like, how much further can it go on? So then when we had the like loss, yeah, it gave us that kind of like cleansing moment, and we could, you know, get some energy back and go again. And the first few matches back since that period as well, it just feels very intense again. So I don't know. I haven't even really been, I haven't been following the matches as analytically as I used to. It's just kind of like, just get through it situation for me at the moment, so I can't really comment on if I feel like we're too loose at the back or anything like that. But yeah, I do think the goal was a bit bad from them, so yeah,
it's interesting though, isn't it? I mean, it's something that I watched the highlights back this morning, and it's just like, it's completely different for me having the chance to look at things back again compared to when I'm living them live, when I'm like a sort of, you know, a jellied eel. Or, you know, in a can, I'm just sort of, that's been sort of opened and then pushed around a bit, you know, and I'm just sort of wobbling around, and I've, you know, petrified in this jelly watching this game, but obviously loving things as they transpire, because generally speaking, it's going our way. We're top of the league, despite everything, despite referee bias, despite an extraordinary injury list. And let's go through that game one by one in terms of all the highlights, and we'll talk about all the things that crop up as we do that. So at the beginning of the game, in the first half, the first thing Sheffield United do is win a throw. Jack Robinson, of course, you remember, it got nodded on. It was a great throw in, to be fair. Thomas Gronewark would have been proud. Nodded on. And then McAtee, completely unmarked at the back post, had this shot. And it was a magnificent save, Kev. A magnificent save. And I was looking at Kelleher, because now, as the commentator said on TNT Sport, was it last night? He's now played as many games in all comps as Alisson Becker. They've played 24 each. But what's interesting stat before I ask you about Kelleher, Steph, is that, Steph? What do I call you, Steph? Kev, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm thinking about Stefan Ortega as well. I've got loads of stats. Okay, bear with me. See if this makes any sense whatsoever. Queevin Kelleher, his save percentage is 72.7%, Premier League only. He's played 9 matches in the Premier League. He's faced 33 shots. He saved 72.7% of that, which is extraordinary, because I can give you David Raya's save percentage is 66%. Ederson's save percentage, 69.4%. Alisson Becker, 75.3%, which is the second best in the league, because the best in the league, believe it or not, is Stefan Ortega with 76.5% save accuracy. But this is all Premier League only, and he's only played 5 matches in the Premier League, so he's only had to face 17 shots. But he's managed to save 76.5%. So the sample size is basically too small for Ortega, although he's doing very well. The sample size is much bigger for Queeve and for Alisson, who are both much better than David Raya and Ederson. And there's something about that stat that's just so reassuring, Kev, that Queeve is, I mean, he's great with his feet as well. You know, his passing accuracy is magnificent. And I'm beyond any doubt. I'm positively delighted to see him line up for Liverpool these days. How are you feeling about Queeve and that save?
Well, he's from the same part of Ireland as me. We're both from Cork. He's an exceptionally young keeper, and he's done everything that's been asked of him. The fact that he stayed this year surprised me, given that for the Republic of Ireland, Gavin Bazunu was given the number one shirt. And Kelleher was basically told by the last manager, if you're not playing, I can't pick you. So the fact that he committed to stay this year, the fact that Liverpool turned down a reasonable bid from Nottingham Forest for him is brilliant for us. He's just like Kwanzaa, he's just like Bradley, in the fact that you see him in the team sheet and you are, like you said, you're grand with it. It's not a problem. He's a very good shot stopper, we know. His decision-making with his feet is fantastic. His composure is brilliant, and he's learning from the best. The thing, I think there was one game earlier in the season where he cheated coming halfway out of his box. He was outside of his penalty area, and he was way too far out taking the ball, and he got caught. That's the one glaring standout mistake, I think, that he's made this season. Other than that, he's been pretty flawless. I don't think he could do much about any of the goals. You know, he hasn't had any howlers, you know, and if you're a number two keeper, that's all you can hope for. But he's way better than that. He would start for the majority of Premier League clubs comfortably. You know, I think it'll be very difficult this summer for Liverpool to keep him, unless something else happens with, unless Alisson asks to leave. I think that's the only way that a decision would be made on Alisson Becker. But I think it'll be very difficult going forward to keep Creeping Kelleher. You know?
I think we should do a thing with Creeve, and that he's only allowed to go on loan deals until Alisson retires. So for the next 4 or 5 years, I mean, you know, it's never been done before, but that way it's so everybody's happy, because he gets to play for Liverpool when Alisson, you know, Alisson's form inevitably drops. And we get to keep, you know, one of the best goalkeepers in Europe, in my opinion. And it's just a solution, like, you know, so he can come back. He could be Liverpool's number one. He could be Alisson's successor. We can sort of guarantee him that. And he gets all the first team action that he deserves. What about that, Kev? I don't know why people aren't talking about that as a solution.
It's, it happened with Thibaut Courtois when he went to Atletico Madrid for 2 years on loan. Mm-hmm. And he came back then to become Chelsea's number one. The difference is with goalkeepers and the way that Alisson injuries, he's picked up a few injuries, but in general, he is the best keeper in the world. And he's still at an age where he's probably got 5 years at the top level, at the elite level, before you'd even consider him dropping off. The only question about Alisson is he going to be committed to staying in England for that part of his career, or is it there a question that maybe a Real Madrid might tempt him? You know, they do have a lure for South American players. It is an ambition for the vast majority of South American players to play for a Barcelona or a Real Madrid, but it would take a monumental offer to get him out of Liverpool at the minute. I mean, I don't mind the idea of Creeve going on a 2-year loan or whatever and have his long-term career linked to the club. But eventually the club have always been like this. The club have always been very fair with players. If they're not going to stand in the way of a player progressing their career. He's too good to be a number two keeper. He just is. So,
someone pays, you know, like let's say a 5 million loan fee for a season. They get a great goalkeeper for a season, and then we get to keep him on our books. That's what I would do.
That's if he's comfortable with that. You know, if he's okay with that, then that's fine. But I'd be honest, I think that eventually he's going to want a family, he's going to want to settle down, and he's going to want a base somewhere where he's going to be playing regularly. He can commit to an area, commit to a club, raise a family, do whatever. It's not as simple. I wish it was. If it was up to me, I'd keep him at the club for the rest of his career, because I think he's one of the best out there. But there's a decision. It's got to be one of the biggest challenges, I think, for the new hierarchy that's coming into the club in the summer. That's probably one of the biggest questions they're going to have to deal with.
Yeah. Along with, of course, Trent's contracts, first priority, and Mo Salah and Virgil van Dijk as well. I mean, speaking of Mo Salah, I want to come to you about Mo, Abdul. The next highlight apart from the corner, the resulting corner from Sheffield United that, you know, also gave me palpitations. Terrible start to the match again for Liverpool. But after that, we regained control. Lucho started doing some magic down the left wing. The ball ran to Joe Gomez, who put in this sort of floaty cross that most goalkeepers, Kelleher included, would have caught. But Gurbic, which is a great name, Gurbic, it sounds like someone who's particularly angry at someone who he feels has been harsh to him. Gurbic decided to sort of waft the ball towards Mo Salah, which a few years ago would have been absolutely devastating, because that ball would have, you know, had a good chance of curling into the corner. And this is the classic Salah shot. But what pisses me off, Abdul, is that in commentary, you see time and time again, these commentators, he does it twice in every single match, Mo Salah. He has done for ages. And none of them are hitting the target, or if they're hitting the target, they're being very soft. And every single time the commentators are like, well, you would have put money on him scoring from there. It's like, no, I wouldn't. I can't remember, Abdul, the last time that Salah actually scored one of those classic left foot curlers into the corner. I mean, is his form, because there was another one just after that as well, where he did get it on target, but it was an easy enough save. Is his form something that, you know, you could be a little bit concerned about, because his touch was way off in the last match against Brighton? And then yesterday he had a few, you know, pretty poor efforts at goal, but he wasn't really in the match. Or is it just, you know, we just got to be patient and you know, Mo will be angry at being taken off, and he'll take all of his frustration out against Manchester United on Sunday. He's going to score 4 or 5 goals against them single-handedly. I don't know. How are you feeling about Mo Salah these days?
I think with Salah, I think pretty much all of his time at Liverpool, for me, I don't know. Like, I don't want to say it's a bit controversial, but it's like, you know, there's this discourse on the internet, I'll say, where there's a lot of fans from other teams who say that Salah isn't that good. And then Liverpool fans will come back and say, well, he scores like 20 goals a season, every season guaranteed, plus assists, plus he's super strong and blah, 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 blah. And I think from the beginning with me and Salah, he doesn't play football in the way that I like my wingers to play football. I'll say that straight up the bat. Like, I like
your controversial opinions about Mo Salah. Please do go ahead, because I know I remember us having a conversation about how you prefer to watch Riyad Mahrez,
yeah,
than Mo Salah, which is, I can understand it in terms of, you know, dribble and drama and magic and silky touch. But at the same time, I think you're completely off your rocker.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean to say I'm not going to give you a chance to talk to me. Try and convince me that you're not completely bananas.
So I think, yeah. So like, yeah, off the bat, I always prefer players who like your Benzemas, your Mahrezes, like you mentioned, you know, Messi, but Messi's in the league of his own. Players who really, I don't know, they've got a lot more grace to their play, whereas Salah is just very focused from A to B. And I think from the first season where he like broke everybody's mind by scoring like over 40 goals, like I just haven't really thought about it that much. Like I haven't thought about, oh, I don't really like the way he plays football. I've just kind of experienced it. I haven't really I love the big goals that he scores for us. And like, I think he's just absolutely electric, lightning in a bottle. You can't define him, basically. But I haven't really, like, I don't know, really, he hasn't really taken to my heart like maybe Coutinho did, I think, in the latter stages of Coutinho's career at Liverpool, or maybe Suarez did. Like, I just think he's this kind of like inimitable figure. Like, he's just like a god to me, Salah, in terms of just, he just does it, you know. But I don't really, like, I don't know, I don't feel like I give it enough credit myself. I just kind of expect it from him. So I say that to basically say, when Salah does go off form, and I feel like this, there's a part of me that wants to like start criticizing him, like, he's not even playing football well, and he's not getting the goals. Like, I don't do that, because I know that he will get goals in a match. So I think the match before, I can't remember who it was, but he was really annoying me, and I was just there like, I think I did tweet something. I was like, Salah's really frustrating me. I don't know why Harvey Elliott didn't start. And then he scored. So that is Salah to me.
Yes, like, against Brighton, when he had 12 shots, a record, yeah, and yeah, only one goal.
Yeah.
It's an interesting game, because, you know, he scored the winning goal, but I wonder if he was truly happy with his performance because his touch was miles off. But that was his first start since January the 1st.
Yeah.
You know, so we can't be too harsh on him. And as you say, he always does produce the goods.
Exactly.
Do let me know in the comments how you're feeling about all this this Mo Salah stuff as well. You know, I'm trying to go through a few comments. We've got Manny in the chat. Nice to have you with us, Manny Tangadurai. Excuse me if I mispronounced your name. On Mo Salah, Manny says Salah deserves a lot more credit. I think injuries are taking a toll on him, so he's got to adapt his game. He's still a dependable and legendary goal scorer. And Gary Richards is in the chat. Gary Richards, tally ho, Gary. He says Salah is great. And I think that pretty much sums it up. Just Salah is great. Absolutely. Because what I like about Salah, though, Abdul, I get what you're saying in terms of the magic, the je ne sais quoi, the beauty and the joy of seeing someone do these like incredible skills, the Ronaldinho type. You don't get that from Mo Salah. But what you do get is an incredible touch and, for me, an incredible sense of space. A better sense of space than I've ever seen from any other professional footballer, in that he doesn't need to dribble past you, but he'll be past you. And the timing of his runs, when you look at last night, we had a number of shots from outside the box that didn't go too well. Mo Salah was always following them in, and he's done that for years, ever since he joined us and before, because he times his run off the back of the shoulder to get any kind of rebound. Once in 300 times, he'll get a rebound tap-in goal. But he makes that run 300 times for that one tap-in. And I love that about Mo Salah. But yeah, I mean, because the, you know, like I said, we've got a load to get through. I don't want to stay on Salah too long, but it's very interesting to have your views. Thank you very much. And we're going to stay. I mean, I think he's great. I agree with Gary Richards, and I'm sure lots of people do. The next highlight for still in the first half was that there was a corner that was played short to McAllister. He rolled it back to Joe Gomez, and then Joe Gomez, from quite a central position, played this sort of floaty cross that was a floaty ball in that was nodded wide by Darwin. It was a hell of an effort by Darwin. After that, there was a foul on Joe Gomez by Vinicius Souza, and then Szoboszlai's free kick was half clear to Salah, which was that high and wide Salah classic to the top corner that never finds the top corner. I'm in a mood to just tell him to stop shooting in that position, to be honest. But anyway, then it was the goal, Kev, the goal, the first goal. Kev, we've been watching Liverpool for a long time. I've never seen a Liverpool player charged down a goalkeeper's kick and it goes straight in. Klopp called it one of the best goals, one of his favourite goals. And I totally understand, because it's a goal that comes from pure determination and optimism. And just, you know, you're making this run, and I swear no one's going to score a goal like that for another 20 years, because it's so rare that the goalkeeper actually hits it right at the back of his thigh. It was a no-look goal. The no-look goals are back, and it sort of bounced into the goal. But there was something beautifully satisfying about it. How did you feel about that goal, Kev?
Love it. I love everything about it. You'll see those goals across the league, maybe one or two a season, where forward will charge keeper down. I remember Sadio Mane got one, but he charged keeper down, he blocked it, and he managed to tuck it away. But it was it's the reason why you chase a goalkeeper down. And I don't understand for the life of me. You're asking your striker, who doesn't have to track back and defend at the edge of his box. He's one of the fittest players in the side. You're asking him to do one thing, force the goalkeeper to play the ball early when he doesn't want to. That's all you're asking him to do. The odds of getting a deflection or anything like that are so slim. The only reason that you're doing it is to force the goalkeeper into making a pass when he doesn't want to make it. So it might go out for a throw. He might panic. He might get it to the wrong guy, but you're going to get the ball back quicker. That's the only thing about it. And when you see what happened last night, it's reward for the dozens upon dozens of times that he will do that, and he will get nothing for it. and thanks is your, you know, you'll get no thanks for it. You get sore legs and cramps because that's all he's got to get at the end of it. But at the end of the day, that's what you do. It's a brilliant goal because it just shows the ethic of the side. So many big-time Charlie players can't be bothered to do that. The great players chasing a ball into the keeper. You know, the average Joe Soaps, how many times did Sheffield United put pressure on Grieving Keller last night to play the ball early? Not once. Never happened. Why? Because they're terrified of what, leaving space behind them. They're afraid to take a risk to try to win because they're terrified of losing. And that's the difference between Premier League sides and the elite sides. You know, yeah. You have to be brave enough to try and win something when all else, when it's not working for you. And it wasn't. I thought we were, that first half, we were poor. We were pedestrian. We were one-paced. Apart from the goal, the best bit of I saw that first half was Darwin chasing a ball that Mo played inside him towards the byline that he managed to get a cut back on. And I just wish Luis Diaz was coming in on the other side to ram it home because it deserved to be put away. The endeavour to run like that, I love it. I love that aggression and that passion and that willingness to do it when you'll do it 100 times in a game and nobody notices. You know, we noticed that one because you got a goal. But you watching Sunday, they will chase down Onana all the time. Why? Because they want to make Onana play the ball when Onana doesn't want to play it. And you can't teach that. That has to be in. That's why the transfer committee deserve so much credit for the quality of signings that we bring into the club, that they all buy in. There's no big time Charlie. There's no attitude problem. Everyone does what's needed to be done because the team is everything. And Darwin is doing that. Darwin's phenomenal. 30 goals contributions this season so far, and he's not finished. You know, we're starting to see glimpses of why Darwin Núñez is one of the best strikers in the league. And Liverpool fans are terrified to say it because it's Erling Haaland, it's Man City, it's the fee, it's this. I wouldn't swap Darwin Núñez for Erling Haaland. Never in a million years. Erling Haaland is a phenomenal finisher. He's a bang average footballer.
Very interesting.
He's got no interest in playing football outside the box.
I agree. He's a lethal finisher. He's an advanced forward. Liverpool, it wouldn't work in Liverpool. It's not a Liverpool system, is it?
Goldbridge got loads of stick for it, but he was dead right in what he said.
Yeah, because he was saying the same thing, was he? Haaland wouldn't work in Liverpool. Well, he's absolutely right. If you disagree with him, then I don't know, email me, coponpodcast@gmail.com, and I can tell you in more than 240 characters and a very long essay about why you're completely out of your mind if you think that Haaland would do well at Liverpool. No, you're totally right, Kev. This is it. I mean, it's Darwin. He's an absolute genius. The next highlight after that is when Lucho picked it up, and everything was so central in that first half, Abdul. All of our, you know, like the Joe Gomez floaty ball that Darwin headed wide. The next highlight as well was when Lucho picked it up. He drove centrally, beat a couple of players. He slipped it to Darwin Núñez, who did this sort of jinky twinkle toe stuff and then had a tame left-footed shot that was fairly easily saved by Gerbich. But there's something just beautiful about watching Darwin play. I mean, last night he got that one goal. He had seven shots, which is the most in the team. Mo Salah had three. McAllister had three. Luis Diaz had three. Cody Gakpo had four in 20 minutes, which is pretty impressive. But Darwin Núñez had seven shots throughout the game and only two of them on target. He had no key passes, but a 71.4% passing accuracy, which, you know, his passing accuracy varies wildly from 55% to 85%. 71% is not bad for him. But it's just something about him playing. It's just the fear factor, Abdul. That's what you don't get in the stats. Manchester United, they've got problems in defence that, you know, lead them to play Harry Maguire. And also this young kid, I can't remember his name. He came on yesterday, Kembwala, something like that, because Varane's injured. Even Johnny Evans is injured. So whoever this young kid is, I think it's Kembwala, but do correct me if I'm wrong. And Harry Maguire, I mean, they're not going to sleep for two nights. They're going to be on the sleeping pills, probably prescribed to them by the Man United doctors, because it's Darwin's going to be haunting them in their dreams, isn't he, Abdul?
Yeah, I think Darwin is, I think everybody like kind of predicted it. Not everybody. Obviously, in his first season, he got a lot of criticism and people were saying, oh, he's pony, why did we sign him? He's missed too many sitters, blah, 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 blah. But the people who stayed level-headed in those moments pointed to his first season with Benfica, where I think he only scored 6 goals and got 10 assists. And then his second season with Benfica, he got like almost 30 goal contributions. So I think he basically exploded in his second season. So everyone who stayed level-headed about Darwin said, his second season at Liverpool, he's going to do really, really well. And as of last night, I think it's 30 goals and assists for this season, which is a great return, considering the fact that, you know, he has actually missed cities as well. So he could actually be he could be much higher up on the table. And I agree with you. I agree with Kev when he says he's just a much better footballer, like than Haaland. Like I put a tweet out a couple matches ago where I remember Darwin got the ball out on like the right hand side and it was like bouncing like hip height, and he basically like hit it on the half volley with the outside of his foot across the pitch. And it was the kind of thing that you just remember Luis Suarez doing, where like you weren't sure that he had the technique in him. It's not something he does it every single week that you just know he can do it, but like he just had the perfect technique to do it. And I described it in that moment as he's now like in a form of confidence where like he doesn't even need to think about doing things. He just visualizes it, and he knows he's got the body, he's got the physicality, and he can make it happen. And he's got the technique as well. And he doesn't need to like think about it too much, because I think a lot of people have noticed that when he has to think about things too much is when he messes up. So now he's in this vein of confidence where like he doesn't think about things for even more than a split second, just does it and it comes off. And he's getting the goals. He's happy. McAllister's there. They're drinking lots of mate together, mates, however you spell
mate.
It. Mate. So yeah, honestly, it's just a beautiful, beautiful time for all of Liverpool's attackers, to be honest. But I think, yeah, especially Darwin, he's really come to the fore this season. Super happy for him. And I think it's only going to get better. I think I do think he's going to go on the Luis Suarez type trajectory where he just gets better and better every season until Real Madrid force our hand and try and get him for like 200 mil.
Oh, good Lord. I mean, I hope not. I hope that by then Real Madrid would have folded due to tax irregularities, but who knows. Big chances missed in the Premier League is a nice stat that I like to go back to. Right there at the top of the table is, of course, if you look at the stats, but absolutely crazily, if you listen to the pundits, Erling Haaland is top of that league of big chances missed. He's missed 27 big chances this season, which is absolutely huge. He scored 18 goals, so he's top of the goal scoring charts, but he's missed 27 big chances. So when you see him in the next match, miss one from 6 yards again, and the commentators are like, "Wow, I can't believe my eyes," then you can just believe that you've already heard it on Cop On Podcast. Darwin Nunez is second on that list, 23 big chances missed. And Ollie Watkins is third on 19. Nick Jackson is fourth on 17. And Rasmus Højlund is fifth on 13. From 23 big chances missed for Darwin, you would think that maybe next season he could get another 10 goals. You know, from that, you know, he'll still miss. Of course he will. But if he's down to sort of, you know, Alexander Isak miss rate, Rasmus Højlund miss rate, Calvert-Lewin even, in terms of miss rates, then he'll get another 10 goals just in the Premier League alone. Gary Richards in the chats is back in Starwin, as he calls him, to score 40 goals perhaps next season. Then that would be marvellous. But it's just joy, pure joy. At the end of the first half, you know, there's we're building up centrally. Again, Lucho Diaz is involved, and McAllister shoots from outside the box, but it goes just wide, didn't get the curl on it that he wanted. And again, there's more central build-up play. Lucho again involved. Gomez squares it. Soboslai has a drive, which is powerful, but it's too straight, and it's a fairly easy save for Gurbitch, which is a great name I'm going to pronounce again. And then there was a long ball for Sheffield United that was pretty well defended by Liverpool, but then a poor clearance led eventually to a shot by Sheffield United, can't remember who, that was saved low down by Queeve, and that was the end of the first half. In the second half, I was expecting a bit more oomph, gusto, daring do from Liverpool, but it didn't turn out that way. The first highlight of the second half was when Liverpool were passing it well around the box, and then it came to Salah, who had a tame volley straight at the keeper. But then it was the goal, Sheffield United's goal. They played it out from the back, and the offside line was very poor from Virgil. He was like 5 yards behind the rest of our defenders. Had he been in line with the rest of our defenders, they would have been offside. But as it was, McAtee ended up getting the ball out wide, jinking around Joe Gomez a bit too easily, but I don't like to be too critical. And the header by, as I said before, I don't know who his name is, but I'm going to call him Hodor. It went in off the outside of Connor Bradley's right boot. And at that moment, I was shitting myself, even if you weren't, Kev. I'm glad I asked you before how you were feeling. But in terms of a goal, that was a pretty, I don't know, it was a freak goal, much like Darwin's goal is in some sense a freak goal. There's not much we can learn from that, is there, other than the offside line? I don't know.
No, I think the Gravenberch should have made the tackle earlier. Yeah, okay. he didn't pull out of it, but he should have got to the ball. Okay. Gomez should have read who he's up against and not commit so quickly, because that's what he tried to jump in really quickly to win the ball back. He didn't need to. All he had to do was keep him where he was, allow players to get back, and then you hold your shape from there. Other than that, I mean, stick on Joe Gomez for a sec. I thought he did really well again last night, but the difference between him and Robertson is night and day, and that's not a slight on Joe Gomez whatsoever. I think Joe Gomez is having arguably his best season for Liverpool, arguably ever, I think. But he's not a natural orthodox left wing back, left back. But yeah, that was the mistake. The Gravenberch was the first mistake. Joe Gomez was the second mistake. The rest of it is just one of those things that can happen when you've got a one goal lead. That, you know, a 1-0, a deflection, a foul that's not given, and you're 2-0. Anything can happen at 1-0. You have to be more clinical to put these sides to bed. This is a side that Arsenal rattled, what, 4 or 5 past the other week. You know, you're at home in the middle of a title run. You have to be dispatching these sides. And at 1-1, when the crowd got up and Klopp decided to ring the changes, the intensity and the urgency set, the alarms went off. And, you know, they must have realized we're 30 minutes away from blowing this, you know, and reality set in, you know, that nobody's going to give this title to us. You know, sides aren't going to roll over. And if your mentality isn't bang at it all the time, then you won't win it, because Man City and Arsenal aren't going to go away.
But there was a tactical thing as well, which was great, because obviously as soon as we conceded that goal, the subs were ready to come on anyway, Elliot and Robbo. And Kev, just staying with you quickly, I don't know how much of a fan of figure skating you are. I'm not, but I did see on Reddit a wonderful video of this champion, I believe he's 19 years old, American guy called Ilya Malinin, right? And I've never even ice skated in my life, but I went roller skating twice and fell over so many times that I never did it again. But what's amazing in figure skating, there's this move where you're skating and you've got to build up this momentum on the rink, right? So he's building up this momentum, and you jump and you do this sort of horizontal quick flip, and then you land forward again and you keep skating, yeah. Right? This, I can't remember the name of this. Let's call it a spin. It's
triple
or whatever.
Axel.
Pardon?
Triple axel. It's a triple axel.
Oh, man, there you are. Either
a triple axel or a salco.
A triple axel or a salco.
Or well, a salco. One of those.
The world champion, right, the new one, it's never been done before. He's 19 years old. He can do 4 spins in one jump. They call it a quad.
Salco, then. Yeah, which quadruple
is a quadruple salco, which is absolutely insane. But anyway, I'm getting to my point. Bear with me, everybody. He makes it look freaking easy if you watch the video. Ilya Malinin, check it out. It's amazingly graceful to watch. He does these 4 spins quicker than the camera can move, you know, can capture it, moving images, excuse me. And it's a blur, and he lands and he carries on as if nothing's happened, as if, you know, he's just opened the door to let the dog out. He's not even going out with the dog. He just can't be bothered. He's going to sit back on his sofa. And Jurgen Klopp, this is my point, makes these changes in games. And we've seen over the years so many times. And for me, he's gotten even better over his 8 years at Liverpool. And it's borne out by the amount of late goals we get, the amount of late winners we get. He makes these tactical changes in games that he explains afterwards. And it's so simple, his reading of the game, because it wasn't working. Joe Gomez being an inverted fullback, everything going centrally. What we needed was more overlaps and underlaps. And he put Andy Robertson on the pitch with that specific instruction. And lo and behold, just a few minutes after, it was great build up down the left. Robbo on the overlap plays the low cross in, which is then, you know, the clearance is deflected back to McAllister, which, and he glutters it in, you know, the cleanest strike since the latest war crime by some bastard enemy state bastards. Stop that, by the way, if you're listening and you'd like to order airstrikes, just stop it. Have a cup of tea. Email me coponpodcast@gmail.com and I will explain the different solutions that are available as a human. Distresses me, all of that. But back to the footy, Kev. Jurgen Klopp makes these decisions that are magical. It did end up at McAllister's feet, and what a magical goal. I was up, I was running around my kitchen, I was trying not to scream, I was holding in, stifling the scream because my family had gone to bed, and I could not have been happier at that goal. Talk to me about the goal, talk to me about the tactics, talk to me about whatever you want, Kev.
He flipped it to a 4-4-2 because, look, they were, Sheffield United set up in a rigid 5-3-2, but it wasn't. It was five with two of the central midfielders dropping back in as well. So it was seven across the back. And the rest were just filling space. The space was wide. The overlaps were right there. We could all see it. You know, we could all see what needed to happen. We needed to stretch the pitch. There was a part in the first half where you could see it a mile off. It was when Luis Diaz was on the ball on the left, and it happened a few times. The right wing back would come out to Diaz. The right centre-back would come out to back him up. There was a big glaring hole in between where the centre-back and the right centre-back was, and nobody saw it. Nobody made that darting run inside for Diaz to lay one back and play someone in. In the second half, when Robertson came on, that was Robertson of old, getting down the byline, offering an option so that your right wing-back is screwed. You know, he must have saw Robertson taking up the positions he was taking, and it became a pure Andrex moment, because what the hell are you going to do? Diaz has got to go inside you. Robertson's got to go around you. Pick your poison. And Robertson's delivery, and especially his delivery from set pieces, improved us massively. Because Szoboszlai's delivery from set pieces until Robertson came on was poor. But the way we changed to a 4-4-2, and we've got the capacity to do that with the two central midfielders, I thought the bringing on Curtis Jones as well and having him back and available, because of the role he played for England in the Under-21 Championships, which England won, playing as a six or as a second six, as a controlling centre mid, he's got that ability to sit in and allow McAllister free rein to join the attacks and for him to pick up passes. I mean, the cross came in. It was the first of many. I mean, the first and foremost thing that Klopp did was taking Salah off. You know, I think it was premeditated, the fact that it happened on the hour. Mo's still coming back from injury. He's not quite where he needs to be, so last night, give him minutes in the legs, he'll be better for it. But he just wasn't on his A game last night. And having the bravery, first and foremost, to bring him off at 1-1 says everything you need to know about the manager. Changes it to a 4-4-2, and we become more threatening. We started creating more havoc. Darwin started becoming more influential because he started drifting around, looking for the ball. And when the ball comes back to McAllister and he hits it, we've all played football. You know when you hit a ball and you don't feel it coming off your foot, and it just
I've goes. Never had that experience. I've never hit a ball anything like that. It I promise felt you. Like I'd hitting some kind of porcelain teapot, you know, but I've never
hit a ball like that.
Strike like that. Wow.
It's coming back at you at a nice pace. It's at a nice height and you just hit through it. You don't feel the ball coming off your foot. That is just the sweetest, purest strike you'll see. It reminded me an awful lot of Gerrard's goal against Olympiakos.
Ooh.
That, you know, we needed something. You know, we needed something because they were 15 minutes away from coming out of Anfield with a point and solidifying their challenge to try and get back, because we don't know what's going to happen with Everton. We don't know what's happening down the line with future points deductions. They might not need 10 points to get out of trouble. We don't know. But yeah, we needed that massively. And the change has helped. Klopp's ability, Klopp is the best manager in the world at utilizing the five sub rule. He championed it for a reason, but the other reason, he championed it to give longevity to players' careers because of the amount of volume of football they're being asked to play in these times. But the second part of it is Klopp is one of the few managers who's realized football is not an 11v11 game. Football is 16 players on a match day that you can utilize to win a game. And he's got absolutely no qualms about utilizing 16 players to win a game. And he will implement changes to change tactically, to be more as flexible as needed to implement change. That's why you see us sometimes we're pondering towards halftime. You know, we get to halftime, we come out, we tweak something, we adjust something, and we're so much better in second half side. He does it again when he makes his first rapid changes because he'll see how games are evolving. Harvey Elliott is one of the best players at doing this. Harvey Elliott, watch him. Whenever he's on the side, whenever he's also on the bench, he watches the game. He's watching where the space is and watching where he can play and where he can affect games. And he's come on leaps and bounds this season tactically. We're so flexible as a squad. You know, we're so flexible as a squad that we can play two up front. We can play a 4-2-4. We can play a back three if we want. We can do whatever we want within the game, within the structure of the 16 players that we use. And last night was just another example of it. It's not an accident. It's not a fluke that we scored some like 26, 27 goals in the last 15 minutes of games. That's design. Mm. You know, that's design. That's not, you don't accidentally do this.
I think we have to also bear in mind Will Spearman and his pitch control thing, which if you don't know it, listeners and viewers, do check it out. A pitch control by Will Spearman. He's very famous. You probably know, one of the data analysts, but he has this way of analyzing the data from matches about the space that each player is able to dominate in a match. And it's a very original thing that he invented. And I wonder if that's because Klopp's always running down the touchline to look at the data that basically Will Spearman's presenting to him. And I wonder if that also plays into the tactical changes. But it's a very, very good point. But Abdul, I want to give you a chance as well. We're not going to have time to talk about the third goal, which is brilliant. I'm delighted Cody Gakpo scored. He's someone who I'm just going to back forever because he's had loads of critics this season. But I think he's been very, very good, very effective, played in loads of different positions, and he was great when he came on yesterday. Absolutely brilliant. But anyway, I want to give you a chance to talk about that Alexis McAllister goal. I mean, how many times have you seen it? I've got it actually on my phone, and I've just got this 5-second clip that where it just sort of it flies off his boot and goes waltzing Matilda into the top bins. How many times have you seen it, and does it make you weep with joy every time?
Unfortunately, like yesterday's game was a bit of I didn't really watch actually that much of it. I had it on, but I was traveling and my internet was cutting out and in. Oh, no. So yeah, I actually missed the McAllister goal in the moment. Obviously, all my group chats were just pinging like, "Oh my god, McAllister!" But yeah, since then, I've seen it a good 100 times. Yes. Some of us have jobs.
I wasn't working this morning, so yeah, that's all I've done.
I don't know. I'm kind of like in a point with this Liverpool team where I'm just like lost for words. Like, they are excellent, every single one of them, and I mean that honestly. Like, we wouldn't be having the season that we're having if it wasn't for each and every single one member of that squad. And that isn't even like the fluffy talk, like, oh yeah, they do so much in training, but like, they're all getting minutes, all the way down to James McConnell, you know, comes on, starts in his first match, and he gets the assist for a player. Bobby Clark has scored. You know, you've got players like Owen Beck came back from Dundee for like a game, but we needed him for that game, so it was great that he came on. Like, every single player has contributed to everything that we've had this season. So, honestly, like, the McAllister goal was great. absolutely fantastic, but it's like it doesn't even register for me because I'm just so kind of emotionally like spent already. I'm just kind of dragging myself over the finishing line for the rest of the season. I think I'm just saving it all up for when we win, and then I've got to do all the crying for when Klopp goes, and you know, the trophy parade. And but yeah, I'm just lost for words with this team. And yeah, McAllister is literally my favorite player in the squad right now, I would say. And he has been for a while. And yeah, he's just a really special player. And I'm so glad that we got him. Before we even got him, I was saying that he's going to be so important for us. And here he is delivering. And yeah, I hope it just continues. And yeah, just taking it one game at a time. And yeah, that's
beautifully well said. Beautifully well said. Yeah, McAllister, man. The complete footballer. I've been calling him that for a few games now, and he really is. He's the complete footballer. He does everything. Alan C. texted me earlier and said, if you're going to talk about McAllister, please mention the fact that he put in a great tackle not long before he pinged it into the goal. And that's it. You know, he does just as much defensively as he does attacking-wise, and both of them are just sublime. Yes.
Just quickly, I want to say, I genuinely think he's the best midfielder we've had since Gerrard. Like, I know we've had like Fabinho, who was a great defensive midfielder, mm-hmm. and we might have considered Coutinho a great attacking midfielder, but terms of just it all,
yeah.
I don't think we've had a better midfielder than McAllister in a long time. And that's no disrespect to Jordan Henderson or anything like that. Like, you know,
I'm sure Jordan would understand. He's got Alexis McAllister PJs that he ordered last night. They're on their way. Yeah. Kev, you wanted to come in there?
Yeah, I get a lot of stick in our chat now, and it's almost a wind up because I said earlier in the season McAllister is not world class, and I still don't think he's world class.
Controversial opinions. Well, no, Abdul would rather watch the postman delivering letters than Mo Salah play football. And you're just the, you know what, Alexis McAllister's a pub player, is he?
I've got a very high bar of what world class is.
Your definition? Because that's all it comes down to.
Consistency, longevity are the two key factors. There's a lot of very good players.
Okay.
There's a lot of good, very good players out there that do it for a season, for 6 months, for mm-hmm. three games. And you're seeing, like, last night was a world-class performance from Alexis McAllister. Mm-hmm. The last few months, he's a phenomenal. I think he's definitely the pound-for-pound the signing of the summer. He's the signing of the season, without doubt. I wouldn't put him above Gini Wijnaldum just yet. I think Gini Wijnaldum has been the most complete midfielder I've seen at the club in recent years. But Alexis McAllister is 25 years of age. It's a World Cup winner. He has all of the attributes to be one of the best midfielders the club have ever had. He needs to do it season in, season out.
That's fair enough.
You know, I think when you look back at Alexis McAllister at 30, and you're looking at the 5 years that he's been at the club, not just the trophies, but the influence that he's going to have on the players around him, the influence he's going to have on the Curtis Jones, the Harvey Elliotts, the McConnell's, all of these young players that are going to be looking to him as a senior player. I think the world's his oyster. He could become one of the... I mean, I can't stand Bernardo Silva. I'd love to have him in my side. I can't stand Rodri. I'd love to have him in my side because they are consistent world-class operators.
They've been doing it for a few years. That's your key consideration for world-class. Fair enough. Okay.
I think he has all of the ability in the world to be one of the best midfielders in the world. No doubt in my mind. I think the mm-hmm. fact we got him off Brighton for 35 million, we should be going to Brighton and just apologising. Yeah, just we're really sorry. You know, we just
we should just send them some more. Make another transfer and just say thanks. Here's another 25 million.
God willing, we'll be paying them the full transfer fee of £55 million this season or next season because it's contingent on winning trophies. Brighton get paid. We win the Champions League. Brighton get paid.
I'm glad because we've completely ripped them off otherwise.
It's
incredible. I would say, I have a slightly different definition to you, Kev, in terms of world class, because for me, and it's all subjective, but for me, if you're world class, then you would basically get into any team in the world in your position. That's how I would define it. And if I was going to pick a team, a world 11, tomorrow, if I was the manager of Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, you name it, PSG even, you know, any of the top teams in the Premier League, McAllis is in my team. He's one of the first names on the team sheet. And that's my definition of world-class, but we all have different definitions of lots of things. Life is complex. Remember that. It's important. But we've got to move on because we don't have time. I don't know how long you've got, guys, but I'm happy to keep talking. I don't know about you. We've got to move on and talk about Manchester United because at 90 plus 9 minutes last night, Abdul, I don't know if you were travelling around how much you actually saw of it, but at 90 yeah. plus 9, Man United were winning 3-2. Garnacho was looking very smug on the bench, had the little caption man of the match given to him by Ali McCoist. Ten Hag was there. It was raining. He had a hood, but he had the hood down. I always strike that as a bit stupid. Well, you should put the hood up. What's wrong with you? You know, you're trying to show solidarity with the players to get wet. No, keep yourself illness free. Put your hood on, protect yourself, man. But anyway, he was there barking these weird orders in his kind of weird language that he uses. I don't know how anyone can concentrate on what he says. I find it really weird the way he talked, but that's just me being biased and anti everything Man United do. But then, so 90 plus 9, 3-2 Man United, ETH in. Jim, whatever his name is, their billionaire plastics polluting bastard, watching on. The guy's practically ruined most of the planet with his evil. Looking on, thinking, oh well, maybe ETH is the man. And then Cole Palmer, who incidentally, although he played for Man City, is, according to is it Ed Nedem Onuaha? I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
Or he is actually. Pardon?
Cole Palmer confirmed it after the match as well.
Ooh, he was a childhood Man United fan.
Yeah.
Scored a hat trick. He scored 2 goals in 2 minutes, 1 penalty and 1 deflected goal to send Maurizio Pochettino, another overrated and frankly confusing to listen to manager. He was dancing on the pitch. The Chelsea fans were going crazy. My friend David sent me a text after the match, and he said, as a philosopher said about the Falklands War, it was like watching two bald men fighting over a comb, because it ultimately was a pointless match. But anyway, it was a classic match, and we've got to play Man United next. Question is, all this is just for one question, Abdul. Will this result actually work against us for two reasons? Number one, ETH might well get sacked. And number two, they're going to be well up, even more up for the game on Sunday. Or, you know, is it it's going to play into our hands because it's going to further dent their confidence and they're, you know, going to, you know, just continue to, you know, what's the word? Wallow? No. To drown in their pit of mud.
Yeah, so I think after the FA Cup match, I think everybody was like very, I'm sure the entire squad was very keen to just get back down to Old Trafford and rectify the wrongs. I mean, if you could choose one, lose the FA Cup match or lose the league match, I think they would have probably said lose the FA Cup match.
Absolutely.
So I think, yeah, United have been funny this season. I've got a United mate and I said that it's like they're yo-yoing their fans. They'll like put in like a good bit of form, and just before it gets too good, they'll just go back down to shit again. And they'll keep doing that. They'll like get the hopes up, and then they'll go back down to shit. And so because of that, I don't think they're going to get rid of Ten Hag before the end of the season. I think Ratcliffe and Sir Dave Brailsford, I think they're going to probably stick it out with him till the end of the season, and then fresh kind of start with a new manager from that point. If they do bring in a new manager, if they decide to stay with him, I personally think they're crazy. I think somebody described Erik ten Hag the other day on Twitter as it's like hiring a Harkonnen from the Dune series, if you guys have watched it, like Baron Harkonnen. Because it's like he came into the club with this like promise of, you know, he has a philosophy, he coached very well at Ajax, played great flowing football. He was the second to Pep Guardiola at Bayern Munich. So, you know, playing good possession football, he's going to give Man United an identity. And you look at somebody like De Zerbi at Brighton, who comes in day one, they're playing good football. You can see his ideas very clearly, progressing the ball up the pitch, keeping possession in tight spaces, teasing the opponents, all of this stuff. And then at United, they just look disjointed still. They look like they haven't really improved as a team under him. So it's like, you know, what is it? Like, what is the point of keeping him if he's not? So that's the thing that's important for me, especially with Liverpool's search for a coach. It's not really about what a coach has done. It's about how they've done it for me. And I really feel like if you as a coach cannot show the how is working, then what is the point of you? Even if you've won loads of trophies in the past or if you've done well, like it's about how you do it now and how you would do it for Liverpool. And so, yeah, I don't really understand the Ten Hag thing. I think we're going to smash them this weekend. And I'm not usually.
I thought that last time we lost 4-3. I thought that a while ago we lost 2-1.
Yeah. But I never feel like that confident. I never feel like about any team, like even the Sheffield match, I don't want to be like, oh yeah, we're going to smash them. But I really think we're going to smash them this weekend. And that's because of the fact that we owe them revenge. But then also, yeah, you're right. I think their poor form and their showing in their last match is going to rock their confidence. I think they're going to, because they've got defensive injuries as well, they're going to start off on the like back foot. They're not really going to want to attack us so much. They know that we're going to be trying to like avenge our loss. So I think, yeah, their confidence is going to be shot. And I think we're going to try and make sure that we punish them for the mistakes that we made in the last match, because we definitely owe it to them. But yeah, just one final thing on Ten Hag and Pochettino. It's funny. Pochettino also gave him the other biggest like shock loss of his career when his Ajax team lost to Tottenham in the Champions League. Remember that comeback?
Yes, the season that we played them
in the final. Yes. And then also last night. So Pochettino's got two really weird wins against Ten Hag. But yeah.
That is curious. That is absolutely curious. Two lucky wins in a way, and very lucky for Liverpool with the Tottenham one, because I would have much rather played Tottenham than Ajax. That season's Ajax, they were really good. But on the ETH thing, I mean, the rumours are Ratcliffe, that's his name. He puts the rat in Ratcliffe, doesn't he? But he's, the rumours are that he's thinking about replacing Ten Hag with Gareth Southgate, which to me is like trying to fix a leak in your bathroom with a drill, with an electric drill or a pneumatic drill. It's absolute genius if that does happen. Isn't it, Kev? I mean, Kev's got his fingers crossed. I mean, that would be hilarious. But anyway, looking at this game, there are so many ways we can think about things, you know, tactically, emotionally, in terms of the title race. Where's your mind at with regards to Sunday, Kev?
Take the emotion out of it completely. Play the game. You know, take the fact that it's Manchester United will want nothing more than to drag us down, to play an end-to-end game of football and an open game of football. Don't allow ourselves to be drawn into that kind of game. Just don't, you know, just go there, be professional, do a job and get your 3 points and go home. I want to see a calm, proper performance. I'm looking at the lineup that they put out last night. Varane went off injured. They took Rashford off on 66 minutes, or he came on in six. Rashford came on. I mean,
yeah, for Garnacho or Hoyland.
If you allow Manchester United space to play in behind you, they're very good counter-attacking side. I think Hoyland is going to be a really good player. Antony is very hit and miss. Bruno Fernandes is just, he has moments, like he popped up for that goal last night, but inevitably you can get in his head easy enough. Garnacho is a good player, but he's not going to do the ugly work going the other way. I think Kobbie Mainoo is a proper little talent.
He's amazing.
He is a proper little player, and he's going to be a thorn. He's going to be a problem for, you know, in the years to come. But I don't care what they do. I mean, if they want to sit back and play on the counter, fine. You know, we know how to play against that. If they want to come out and man mark us like they did in the cup final and drag it into an end, we know how to deal with that. The difference between this game and the cup final is the fact that the players are refreshed. We've got players coming back. Whereas the FA Cup game, we were on our arse. We were on our last legs. We just come through a huge block of fixtures. This was the last game. And bar the first few minutes and the last 15 minutes of the 90, we dominated the game. And we allowed them back into it. We were poor and we allowed them back into it. And we allowed the game to descend into a game of tennis, a game of chaos. when it didn't need to be. And that was purely down to legs and mental and physical fatigue. We're not in that shape. You know, we go there, do a job, get the 3 points, and just look forward to Thursday night against Atalanta. It has to be that. I mean, there's a few other things. I was just looking while we were chatting there. Klopp has had his press conference already, just to mention it. He came out with David Lynch's report. Jurgen Klopp speaks out about tragedy chanting ahead of the Liverpool's meeting with Manchester United. Wow. And the quotes are, just show a bit of class. That would be my wish for all of us.
Absolutely.
It's one of the things that, look, they're the only side that I hate losing to, more than life itself. Because I know so many fans, so many Manchester United fans in my family and friends when I go to work. It's like, I don't physically, actually, personally know a Man City fan. So I don't care what they do. It doesn't affect me when I go into work on a Monday morning. I'm not going to have someone in my ear who's a Man City fan giving me a chip for 5 days. It's not going to happen. Sure. But a Manchester United fan, you can't lose to these, you know? And even when we were rubbish, you can't go to Old Trafford and put in a crap performance. You have to go and do something. They're rubbish. They're absolutely crap. But they will be up for this. Like you've never seen before, they will be massively up for this. In the same way as Everton will be up massively up for the derby. Because if they can throw a spanner in the works against us, they will love nothing more. And forget professional pride or anything like that. Their season hinges now on this result. If I was I just had a text off Chris Brack, actually, from Tottenham Cop. And he said to me, if we draw or win on Sunday, mathematically, Manchester United can't catch us in April. You know what I mean? And we've got 7 games to go, and they cannot catch us.
Well, they're in the race for sixth, which is their rightful position, isn't it?
They are. I just have a quick look at the table here. And, you know,
is it minus one goal difference? You've got the table in front of you.
Yeah, they're minus one goal difference. Wow. 30 games played, down 48 points. Right, they're currently sitting sixth. And at the end of the day, I think the way the European places are going to work out, Chelsea have a game in hand, two games in hand to West Ham. And they're only 2 points behind them. Wow. Chelsea win their game in hand, they go within striking distance of Man United and six. So Chelsea could actually, it's a double-edged sword for Chelsea, but Chelsea could qualify for Europe. But that brings its own set of financial problems next season with the financial fair play rules for UEFA. So, and Chelsea are a country mile over that, let alone what the deductions they face for financial irregularities coming from the Premier League. They're no way compliant with Europe. So here's what it is. All I want us to do on Sunday, strong lineup, aggressive, at it from the start, no messing about, be clinical, be aggressive, get your points, take your confidence from that, no injuries, no stupid bookings, get your points and go home. That's all I want to see out of it, no messing.
I'd say anything for 3 points there. I mean, looking at some stats, Abdul, Manchester United have won just one of their last 11 Premier League games against Liverpool. So in 11 games, Manchester United have won one, drawn four and lost six. But at this stage, Abdul, a draw is a loss, isn't it, for us? Or are we allowed one slip up if we then win the remaining 7 games?
I think that's a really tough question, which has got me looking for the Premier League table just to see if, I mean, yeah, we can technically drop 2 more points, right? And still be top of the league.
If we get a draw, then and Arsenal win the rest of their games, then it would come down to goal difference, I believe.
Yeah. But still, yeah.
We've had bad experience back in 1989, of course, with that before your time. But it remains the only match of football that had me, you know, just on a football level in tears.
Wow. I can't imagine that because obviously we've missed out on it by 1 point. But yeah, goal difference would be.
Yeah, that's what happened in 1989. And it was a goal by Michael Thomas, of course, famously for Arsenal at Anfield. To win the whole season by one goal.
So wait, it was one goal difference split?
Yeah.
Wow.
Liverpool were winning the league and some pretty awful defending let Michael Thomas stream through our high line, playing a high line in the last minute.
Where you just the corner. John Barnes
had the corner. Ball. And he decided to try and dribble past Kevin Ratcliffe, the Arsenal defender, because Kevin Ratcliffe had just gone down with an injury and John Barnes, being the greatest dribbler that had ever existed, decided to dribble past him, which is a fairly decent idea. But the problem was Kevin Ratcliffe made a brilliant tackle. Arsenal broke and Or they won a goal kick, and I can't remember from the. I can't even remember. I blanked it all out. It's just a trauma. So we owe them, although, as my Arsenal supporting friend Alex told me, think of what's happened since 1989, and we've definitely had the upper hand in terms of, you know, winning European stuff. And although the 90s weren't that good, but, like, you know, under Jurgen Klopp, winning titles, and Liverpool are just generally thought of as much bigger than Arsenal since then. But anyway, that was terrible. But anyway, sorry, too many of you speaking me into my crystal ball globe snow globe.
It's brilliant insight, honestly. I mean, I should probably, I knew something big happened in 1989, and I remember, like, you know, there was the big matches, but I can't believe it was that was what happened.
Yeah,
but,
give you a bit of context to that, because Premier League football, first division football, wasn't shown live, okay, back then.
What?
I had literally just came from, we left Ireland in 1987 and we immigrated back from America to England in the April of 89. And I remember being at my uncle's house, and he's an avid Manchester United fan. And this game was on ITV. They broadcast it on ITV. It was one of the most watched games on ITV. I think it was the last game of the season at Anfield. We were unbeaten at Anfield that season. You know, Arsenal were never ahead of us that season.
Wow.
Up until the last few minutes. It's worth looking up, going on YouTube and finding the history of the 88-89 season. It's an unbelievable story. And bearing in mind the context of everything that happened a few weeks beforehand.
With Hillsborough. Of course.
Mm-hmm. So it's worth going through the archives of that season. Spend an hour, a couple of hours, just enjoy that, because it was phenomenal. We ended up signing Mickey Thomas on the back of that season.
And he scored in the 1992 FA Cup final against Sunderland, which sort of did something to repair some of the damage. But no, the scars run deep for that game. But anyway, you just brought me back there thinking about that. But the point is, Abdul, the question is, right, we've got two brilliant rivals. Anyone saying that Arsenal are going to fall off because they have done in the past are just forgetting the fact that they've now signed Declan Rice and are much better because of it. So we've got two amazingly brilliant rivals. You would think that one of them are going to win the rest of their games. Or are you thinking that they're both going to drop points at some point?
Yeah, I felt ages ago, I felt, not ages, like a couple of weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, I was like, I'm sure all three teams are going to drop points at some point. So we need to make sure that we don't lose our heads the moment we drop a point, because it's very likely that they will also drop points. But as the games have been ticking down, it's like no team seems like they want to drop points apart from when they play each other. So it's just like, I don't really... I'm scared, you know. I'm actually very scared to drop points. I don't know who else. We've all got Villa. We've all got Tottenham. Arsenal got Chelsea as well. They got United. They got Everton. Yeah, Arsenal got some tough games. And then Bayern, double leg fixture sandwich in there. I do feel like they will drop points.
They got Wolves away. That's not easy away as well.
Arsenal. Yeah. Yeah, City
of them away.
I think maybe there is a chance that any team could drop points, but I don't know. I feel like we've been burnt twice, you know, thinking, you know, we can just, you know, believe until the last day. I just want to kill it off as early as possible. The moment they make a mistake, I want to capitalize on it. And if they make another one, completely destroy them. Just capitalize on that and end it. And enjoy the last few weeks under Klopp, I guess, rather than go into the final match just like biting your fingernails, wondering if it's going to be or if it's not going to be. Yeah,
that's it. We can take a step back and be very philosophical and just think, well, whatever happens, we just got to be thankful for being here, don't we, Kev? I mean, we should not be here, having changed the complete midfield, and, you know, with all the context of all the refereeing things. I mean, the Diaz offside that wasn't offside against Spurs, the Odegaard handball that wasn't given, the Doku last minute penalty that wasn't given. I mean, there's at least another 4 points on our total minimum, and other decisions that have gone against us and for the other teams. But anyway, we've got no right to be here. So, you know, you can step back and think, well, you know, jeepers creepers, we're lucky to be where we are, and we should just appreciate every minute. Or are you in it with your heart, going da-da-da-da-da-da-da every day? I don't know.
Well, I'm going over to Liverpool for the last game of the season. Weekend of the season. Yeah. I know we're not getting match tickets, but we're all going over. All of us from
Fabulous, though. Going good over. Idea.
And we know we're not going to get match tickets, but we want to be there for that weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone is going to go unbeaten between now and the end of the season. Okay. Abdul is right when you talk about Europe. Arsenal have Bayern. You potentially could have a European Champions League semi-final with Arsenal and Man City thrown into the mix if Man City go through past Real Madrid. I think the one thing for me that goes against Arsenal is the amount of players that they've got on over 2,200 minutes Premier League football played. It's a significant amount of their key players have played an awful lot of football. And the ability that Arteta would have had earlier in the season to be able to rest and rotate players, like he took one chance the other night against Luton where he rotated five players. He won't be doing that again for the rest of the season. Some of the games he's got coming up are really tough. So he's going to have to ask a lot of players to go to the mill for him. And it'll be a monumental effort if they last the pace. Man City are Man City. But again, you wonder how much that attempt at a quad last season took out of their legs. They're not as good as what they were. Their squad isn't as deep as what they were. They're picking up niggly injuries here and there. And they're not as clinical as they were. You know, Kevin De Bruyne is not the player that he was. He's a phenomenal player still, but he's not what he was. I think our strength really is the fact that our squad is that deep, that we've blooded that many younger players, that we can rotate and still be effective in games. But saying that, our mentality has to be bang at it. It's wide open. It's rare you get a three-horse race in a title with eight games to go.
I can't remember anything one. Yeah, it's amazing.
No, anything can happen. We've all pretty much got a very similar run in type of opponents we've got to play. You're generally going to be... There's not many sides that we're going to be playing against that are going to be on the beach. You know, either sides are going to be fighting to avoid relegation, fighting to get into Europe, which bodes well really for... I hate playing sides who are... think they've got nothing to lose or nothing to play for, because they're the type of games your mentality can be a bit off. That you feel a bit like you turn into entitled FC, is what I call it. When Liverpool are coming to town, we're entitled to beat X side. Football doesn't work that way. You're going to have players at clubs that we're playing against, knowing the world spotlight is on that game, that might get the attention to get a transfer in the summer with a strong performance in a game against Liverpool. Anything can happen in football. But at the end of the day, we've overachieved this season by being where we are, with the potential of doing a treble. You know, it's ridiculous for the fact that we've brought our average age down to under 26 of the squad, and we're better, you know. And enjoy the last knock-ins with Klopp. I'm not even bothering talking about new managers or potential new managers anymore, because it doesn't matter. You know, the ownership and the crowd who have been brought in to appoint that guy know a hell of a lot more than me and what they're looking for and what their plans are for the next 5 years. And they're under no qualms to have to tell me anything. You know, they don't owe us an explanation for anything. Last summer's transfer business says they've got as much trust from me to get the decisions right as they need.
You trust that they don't have Gareth Southgate on their shortlist?
I absolutely trust that Gareth Southgate is not even on the Z list or the under 21 coach.
Good.
Driver.
That's a relief. That's a relief. Absolutely. Yeah, but we got to focus on each game as it comes.
Yeah,
and exactly. The Man United game on Sunday, I mean, you know, we've got good news and bad news. I'm going to start with the bad news. The bad news is that Erik ten Hag, surprisingly, has a remarkable record against teams that are in the top four at Old Trafford this season. Man United have won four of their five home games against other teams that are in the top four on that day. The last one was against when Villa were in third place on Boxing Day. Man United beat them very spornily, as most of their victories are, 3-2. That's the bad news, is that, you know, they're very clinical, Man United. They don't need many chances to score, even though they will give you at least 20 or even 30 shots against them. They're just relying on spawn and luck. So that's the bad news, is that their record against teams in the top four has been very, very good this season. But the good news for us is that Liverpool have won 6 of our last 7 away Premier League matches, which is incredible. And the omens are against Manchester United winning 2 home games in the same season against the Reds, because they've only done it twice in their history. So chances are that they're not going to do it again. But who knows? We can rely on the past to tell us about the present. But I think in the present, it's a very different set of circumstances. And I'm very, very happy to have Curtis Jones back, Abdul. I think that's going to make a huge difference. And I'm generally optimistic for this game against Old Trafford. I'm not thinking we're going to spank them. I'm thinking that they're going to get a couple of spawny goals. I think Garnacho's going to score. I think, but I think we're going to have too much. I think we're going to have too much for them, and we're going to get a narrow win, and I'd be delighted. I'll be basically, I'd be as happy as Larry and his best friend, Tim. Yeah. So I don't know. We've been talking for about an hour and a half, so we should wrap it up, really. Abdul, thank you for coming back. Tell everybody about Watch_LFC, please.
Yeah, it's just a Twitter page, but I don't know, we'll see. Over the end of the season, we're just trying to get to the end of the season, but I think beginning of next season, we're going to expand it to Instagram, Facebook, and other platforms. So, yeah, in the process of big expansion. So, yeah, we'll see.
Very nice, because it's a huge account on Twitter. How many followers now? 200,000 or something ridiculous?
Yeah, 215-ish thousand.
Wow. Yeah. Fabulous. Congratulations. Very cool. Very happy for you. Excellent stuff. So, good luck with that. Good luck with that. And always a pleasure talking with you. Some marvelous points as ever. Thank you, Abdul. And Kev, thank you so much as well for being back your second time on Cop On Podcast. Kev is from Talking Cop, which is another podcast. If you didn't know it, then where the heck have you been and all that stuff? Talking Cop, the G on talking has been replaced by an apostrophe. So do bear that in mind when you look things up. But it's a wonderful, wonderful podcast and YouTube channel. They've got post-match shows. Is that what you do that after every game, don't you, Kev? You've got post-match shows and then you've got reviews. You have really interesting. There was a debate about the greatest sports person of all time, Gav is a fan of golf, I noticed, but he didn't mention Harry Vardon, who was one of my best friends when I was younger. He was the grandson of Harry Vardon, who invented the grip that every golfer uses, where you put your little finger between your other two fingers. This was invented by a player called Harry Vardon, who was the Tiger Woods of his day, but it was 110 years ago, where you had to get the boat to America to compete. But anyway, enough about golf, and tell us about Talking Cop and the brilliant stuff you're doing.
Well, Talking Cop, formerly LFC Day Trippers, is basically, as you said, we release stuff most days. We have a members show as well for people to join if they want to, but the main focus of the channel really is to try to raise money for charity. You know, we all love talking about football, and we'll talk about football and sport and whatever till the cows come home, no bother. But over the last few years, we've managed to raise 50, 60, 70,000 euro and more for worthwhile causes. And this year we're splitting it between 2 charities. We're trying to raise 10,000 euro, which we're trying to have 5,000 euro to fan supporting food banks. It's a joint effort between Liverpool and Everton football clubs. Anyone who's been to Anfield will have seen them outside the grounds, and the work they do is phenomenal. It's unfortunate that kind of work is needed in the UK in the 21st century, but it is needed. And they need funds. So if we can help raise 5,000 euro to them, is mad, you know. And the other charity we're trying to raise money for is the Lighthouse Cafe in Dublin, because we're an Irish-based podcast. So the Lighthouse Cafe in Dublin is a homeless cafe that provides ability for people to have, for washing facilities, people to come in at the cold, warm meal, someone to talk to, you know, real life stuff, you know. And 5,000 euro to them will allow them to open for longer, help towards the cost of running, costs of keeping a building going. And, you know, if anyone wants to help donate, it'd be great. But there's a GoFundMe. It's at Talking Cop on Twitter. And, you know, if you can't donate, well, you know, we know times are hard for everyone. But if you can copy the link and share it onto your platforms, so because you never know who you're going to reach. And they've got a golf day coming up. If anyone is in Ireland and interest and likes playing golf and wants to get involved, they can contact Gav Doyle at talkingcop1@gmail.com.
Excellent. Yeah. Well said. I put the link in the YouTube chat if you're watching on YouTube right now. And if you're listening to the audio version, whoever you are, wherever you are in the, I think, 37, 38 countries that this podcast goes out to, I'm delighted, whoever you are, wherever you are, to be going out to so many of you. The link will be in the chat so you can give, you know, whatever you can of whatever local currency you're using. And if you've got it, and as Kev says, if you haven't got the funds at the moment, no problem. Join the club. But please, do pass the link on and send it on to people who might see it, who might be able to donate. And, you know, anything helps. No donation too small. So thank you so much, Kev. Thank you so much, Abdul. Liverpool are going to Old Trafford, the old enemy, the old toilet. On Sunday, they don't have plastic fans like Chelsea or Manchester City. They are very passionate fans, but there's no need for all of this stupid tragedy chanting, of course, from either side. Show a bit of class, as Jurgen Klopp said, and hopefully Liverpool will show a bit of class on the pitch and, drive a nail in the coffin of ETH's career. No, I don't want to say that. That lacks class. But at least we're going to win, and we're going to win the title, and we're going to, dance around Old Trafford, kissing cameras, doing whatever we do from the great memories of Liverpool Football Club, this glorious team that we support. So my name is Owen. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Thank you all. Bye-bye.